This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not.
Good morning, Jan.
Now, David.
Yes.
Apparently, we've got two very different books today.
But they've got something in common.
Yes, shadowy segues.
Our presence in the building. Here we go.
When I read that Robin Anea had a new book, there were certain things I expected. It would be about early Melbourne. It would have historical fact and would be written with humour. Her book, Shutter City, is not like any of her other books. Welcome back, Robin.
Thanks, Jen.
Well, being radio, you will have to explain how this book is different and how it came about.
Well, it makes it hard to explain because it's pictures.
Photographs.
Yeah, that's what's different. Usually my books are very word heavy. If there are any illustrations there, they take a back seat for sure.
Well, the press, the Magunya press, It was sort of something that has come out of, what did you tell us?
A bequest from the Grimwade family, and it funds books on Australiana and history largely, but Australiana topics, and they've done some really exquisite illustrated and photographic books over the years. So when I conceived of the idea of this book, I thought it couldn't be in better hands than Magunya, so it was them that I approached.
And they're an imprint from Melbourne Uni.
It really is
such a spectacular looking book too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great. I love the feel of it.
So it's 20 years of photos between 1856 and 1876. So why did you choose these dates?
I didn't choose the dates. The photos just kind of fell into those dates. So 1856 are kind of the earliest photos of Melbourne that you can lay hands on. So that was easy. The ones I ended up with are sort of 1874, 75, getting on to 76. And I was really glad when I looked at the spread of photos I had that they all fall in that pre-marvellous Melbourne period, because Melbourne in the 1880s, when it boomed, changed completely. So many of the buildings you'd see in this book were gone as a result of that boom, just the same as subsequent booms have rubbed out so many of those buildings. So the 1880s, a lot of these very frontier town looking buildings that look like they're just held up with sticks, they went.
Like Sally's.
Yeah. Like Sally, which was the Sal de Valentino. It was like a big circus tent built in with a bit of timber just to keep it up. Opposite Parliament House at the corner of Spring Street and Burke Street during the height of the gold rush in the early 1850s. And it began as a circus, a horse circus, but very soon it developed into a very seedy dance hall. It was known as the Sally because I guess people saw the word S-A-L-L-E and they weren't native French speakers, so they went, Sally's close enough. And it was built in a neighbourhood that had been fairly high tone and, of course, had Parliament House opposite. But there were very respectable neighbours whose lives were made a hell by the Sally. So we see the earliest photo in the book is the final days of the Sally, and it's just become a giant billboard, as defunct buildings often are.
The contrast between the Sally, which yesterday's wind would have blown over, it looked like, to the house next door, which was this two-storey brick mansion, and that owner said, was constantly saying, get rid of the Sally.
The magistrate suggested he move house instead. They knew it was a lost cause.
Well, there was the Victorian exhibition of 1861, and it was a government initiative to showcase the colony's produce and the city just before the London International Exhibition of 1862. Mm. But the photographers, they were out and about, but they had their problems too. The paper for photos had only just been made. The long images, exposure images. Mm. So what happened with people?
Well, they disappeared into ghostly smudges if they were there at all. But often the photographers were out at dawn, at daybreak, especially in the summer months. They'd be out there capturing the streets before there were people in them. But you certainly get these smudgy images. Sometimes they could get people to stand very still and keep their hats on for long enough to actually actually show up in the frame. And, a lot of people did put their hands up to have their business premises photographed for that exhibition and to have their business showcased in London as one of the success stories of this wonder city on the other side of the world.
Now, you've included photographs in Shutter City quote, not because the picture is a good one, but because you say they have sparks. What do you mean by sparks?
Well, the sparks are, I guess, the special feature of this book. So they're not just streetscapes of early Melbourne, but on the pages following those streetscapes, I pick out, illuminate particular details, these what I call sparks, particular details that just looking with the human eye at that streetscape are not revealed to you. But thanks to the times we live in, where you can go to a state library, national library website, download this mega huge TIFF file and zoom in on it to 400% or whatever and see practically what people had for dinner.
It is like that. And thankfully, in the back of the book, you've told us how to do it. And I did it. And I thought, my goodness, there's just so much fun in all of this.
Yeah, that's right. So you can definitely go and delve for yourself, yeah.
Well, the title being Shutter City, but she said you could have also called it See What I Found.
That was really how it began, because, you know, when you write books, you tend to get invited to go and talk in libraries and so on. And because images aren't a part of my books usually, I take advantage of, you know, the slideshow kind of format that you can do in those venues, and found images like this and started zooming in. And so I would go along to a library and say, look at what I found. Have a look at this. I told you about public toilets, public urinals in that last book. Well, look what I found.
Well, there's photos of streets. No cars, of course. So how did you park a horse?
You parked it generally in the middle of the street.
In the middle of the street.
Well, it made sense. There were no tram lines, and the gutters themselves were 3 feet, say nearly a metre deep, to carry the floodwaters down to Elizabeth Street, which was the city's drain. So you wouldn't park on the edges of the streets. So it was too hazardous. You'd step out of your gig and into the gutter. Oh. So you parked in the middle of the street. So it was quite a different look.
And a street sign. Now, what would you do at a walk over crossing?
Walk over crossing, yeah. You think you would walk over the crossing, but it was actually, it was an advice to the driver of a horse-drawn vehicle, or just of a horse, to slow down when crossing the street. There were no lights, there were no police giving directions, so you had to slow down.
That was
and not drive
sign.
Furiously, as they said.
In the street, we can see water taps with ladles attached. Mm. Coffee stalls, and there were two in just the one block of Bourke Street.
Yeah, in the mall.
And I had to laugh about this. The statue of Bourke and Wills. If you can imagine it, in the intersection of Russell and Collins Street, that was causing problems there too.
That's right, yeah, it was a bit of a traffic hazard. It was also a pickup spot, apparently. Mm. Yeah, unlikely, because you think it'd be pretty windswept up there on the hill, but people used to gather and pretend to be, you know, inspecting the fine detail of the of the scroll work or whatever, and in fact they were for an assignation.
And on the corner of Collins and Elizabeth Street, there was a china shop.
That's right.
You didn't have to be careful of bulls.
No, but it was. There were several crashes of vehicles through the doorway of the china shop on that corner. As late as 1874, some of the later photos, a week after the photo was taken showing the splendid veranda of what was then a tobacconist's on that exact same spot, a crash of a vehicle knocked the whole veranda down. So there was something about that. There wasn't much of a hill there. It was just I think
corner,
people just, their attention
spot.
Was their attention was caught by something else, not sure what.
And, of course, this is a detail. There was an opossum rug store. And we get your extra detail of telling us how many possum skins it took to make up a single blanket.
That's right. Yeah, there was a lot to it. It was something like 40 or 50.
72.
There you go. So much for my memory. Yeah, 72 and sewn together with kangaroo sinew, and they were a very sought-after item.
Of course, you know, in a streetscape, and especially in Melbourne, there's hotels. Mm. There's the photos, but we learn from Rob and Ian just what happened behind some of those. What went on behind the Butcher's Arms Hotel?
Oh, the Butcher's Arms. There was a rat pit behind the Butcher's Arms. So imagine a boxing ring. Well, this was a ring into which, I say, 100 rats would be emptied and then a terrier thrown in. And people would bet on how long it would take the terrier to kill all the rats. 10 minutes or so the champion could do it in.
10 minutes.
And I mean, it was obviously a huge betting opportunity, but it was everyone from parliamentarians to, you know, the street sweeper would turn up there. It was a very democratic sport, racing.
Well, on the other side of thought, there's Joseph Sullivan from Sullivan Cox Inn, and he designed the first public fountain and patented a powerful disinfectant. Thank you very much, Robin, for that information.
Oh, yes, there's some terrific stories about his disinfectant being used in the coroner's court.
Now, more official painted signs. On some of the walls and alleyways, it read, "Commit no nuisance." What did that mean?
That meant don't wee here. But people ignored it because there is a photo in the book of the side of a hotel, side wall of a hotel, that has a very big sign saying "Commit no nuisance," and there's an entire gallery of waist-height trickles along that wall. So it was widely disregarded.
The very first photo in the book of Shutter City was of the construction of the GPO on Burke and Elizabeth Streets. But in the forefront is a neat little pagoda type of building, quote. You got us to zone our eyes in to something else happening there.
I did. That was called an illuminated indicator. It was one of Melbourne's first public urinals. But from the rear of it, there was a little shallow drain that was emptying into the Elizabeth Street gutter. I mean, everything just went along the surface. But the illuminated indicator was fabulous because you can actually see them in the book. It was made of glass. It was illuminated inside. Sounds weird for a public toilet, I know. And the windows were painted with advertising for local tradespeople and shops. So you actually had to approach and stand very close to it to read these ads, and you can see them for yourself in the photo.
Look, there's so much in this, and we're just sort of scoffing over it now. But in the photos, there's very few trees.
Mm.
There's one that was in St Francis Church.
Mm.
What happened to it?
It was eventually cut down around 1892, so it was one of those few remaining gum trees from pre-settlement Melbourne. It was beloved by the early settlers, and they fought its removal, but eventually it was taken down about 1892 or something and made into various bits of church furniture, a chess set and a cabinet for the State Parliament, which is still there.
So we learn about the photographers, a little bit about them, and it's just really interesting. There's so many facts in this book, but our eye is guided. It's so much guided. And we also learn what was there before Flinders Street Station.
Yeah. Fish market.
Ah, no, very
interesting. It was a grand fish market, too.
And the floods of 1863. Lots. Shutter City has photographs of early Melbourne. They come alive as Robin Annear guides our eye into the detail and describes it with her insightful humour. Thank you so much, Robin.
Thanks,
where can
Jen.
People get it?
Anywhere.
Great. Have a look at it. You know, it's fantastic.
Now, we may find a connection with my book today, but we won't know that till the end.
Ooh.
Kidnapping, violence and revenge come to the fore in Christian White's latest novel, The Long Night. So, Christian, welcome to 3CR.
Thank you so much for having me. And that intro, by the way, is great. Violence, kidnapping, a bio.
Good friendly sort of reading material. And we've got to be careful how we talk about this book because we're in danger of giving things away because there are all sorts of twists and turns that take place in this novel.
Every single one of my books, I can't really ever talk about them. With my last book, I remember The Ledge, the first person who asked me, you know, what is it about? I panicked and I just lied. I just told a lie. So I promise you I'm going to try to tell the truth, but I may be very vague. You've got the same problem.
Yes. Well, basically, it's this sleight of hand you use. The very opening line, I mean, M is going to die alone. Now, it's all been set up. We've got a cover of darkness, a barn, who will survive till daybreak. But who is M and why is she going to die?
Well, M is this 19-year-old woman, kind of confused, living in a small town in the Dandenong Ranges. She wants to be a horror screenwriter, so I borrowed a little bit from my own life. And in fact, I had to pull a lot of that back. Some of my editors said, you know, people don't really need to know about a deleted scene in the DVD release of The Exorcist. You could probably just cut all that stuff out. So she's a big horror fan. And the reason she thinks she's going to die alone is she's on a blind date. She's met this woman online. She's never met her in real life. and now she's late and she's going to die alone.
But you've set up the expectation. You know, it's that attitude and used as a metaphor, you know, sort of figurative speech. Oh, you know, it's not going to work, I'm going to die. But so that's, you're playing those two threads simultaneously.
Yeah, because later on, she really might die alone multiple times. So it was a good opening line, actually. I have terrible opening lines usually. Often my editor will cut out the first paragraph, but this one was there from the beginning.
So that's one form of deception. Another form of deception is you describe events and we're left wondering, what the hell is going on here? Holly steps down hard on the brakes, then yanks the wheel to the left. The car locks up. The tyre screams against the bitumen. The Forester wrenches sideways, its back end kicking out. Gravel spits up from the shoulder of the road. M grabs the armrest, digging into the upholstery with the fingernails. You've set up the intensity, and yet we're waiting to find out what has caused the panic, why Holly's had to take command of the vehicle, turn it, twist it. And, you know, all the expectation is set up. So you're toying with the reader here.
Yeah, it's funny because I think that if, with any of my work, if you, at the end of the first draft, I'll usually write a timeline. And whenever I look at the timeline, the series of events are actually quite simple. It's really just about when you reveal certain things, you know, certain things to the audience. So, yeah, I think about that a lot, and just what the what the reader is thinking, what the reader wants, what they expect, and then when to mess with their heads.
Yeah, well, you're messing with the heads all the way through this, because we don't know why the car has had to careen off the road and all of these sorts of things. But by the end of the chapter, now, how much can we say here? What happens to M at the end of this first chapter?
I think we can safely reveal that at the end of the first chapter, M is kidnapped in a really creepy, intense way. And then the rest. And, you know, that was a... It's funny because this is the first book. All of my previous work is... my last four books are all thrillers, but I used to think about them as... You know that horrible way that people cook lobsters where they put them in the thing and they put them in the pot and they turn it up slowly so that slowly boils? I'd always had that image with my first three that I wanted to slowly build up the tension. This one, it just boiled. It's just boiling water from the beginning.
Straight in the pot.
Yeah, straight away it's boiling. And then I had to... Okay, now I've got to up that and up that and up that.
And it keeps going up because now we get to the second thread, which is Jodie. She's an artist. She's waiting to hear from her daughter. But her artwork speaks to a past which is quite traumatic. This painting is sort of creepy, right, he says. It is supposed to be creepy. And Jodie flips her phone shut. She's been trying to get through to her daughter. The room isn't literal. The lack of furnishing represents a desolate psychological space, a mental prison. The unused electrical outlet suggests the barest connection to the outside world. She points to the splash of colour. The red ribbon draws the eye. It's a talisman against the encroaching darkness, the girl's last fragile link to the outside world. So you're upping the ante here, but there's Jodie waiting on her daughter, and that painting reveals a psychological trauma from the past.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's funny because usually the way I work is I'll have a hook. You know, what if you were kidnapped? What if this kidnapped? What if someone was murdered? All of that sort of stuff. But then usually what I'll do is I'll marry that with just something I'm. For reasons unknown that I'm interested in. You know, my first book was, a lot of it was about Pentecostal snake handling, which makes me sound like a psychopath. I wasn't into it from a practicing point of view, but, you know, it's these people who worship God by handling venomous snakes. And I thought, okay, I'll tell a kidnap story and I'll shove that. I'll marry them together. And I've done that with all my books. And this one originally was going to be this kidnap story with sort of the world of art therapy. I was really interested in art therapy. And originally, Jodie, this character, was going to be an art therapist. But then as I sort of got deeper, you know, I was in the weeds and I thought, I don't want her to be that far along on her psychological journey. I don't want her to have realized that. I still want her to be just processing this trauma, the secret trauma, onto the canvas.
Yeah, so she's got a past. The painting speaks to that psychological trauma, as you say. Later on, she says, well, if it wasn't art, it would have been drugs and sort of thing. So there's something going on in the background. Again, the reader doesn't know. The reader's got to go and find out. What happens to Jodie at the end of that chapter?
Well, at the end of that chapter, she goes back inside her little apartment in Brunswick, if memory serves, and the lights are off. and the blinds are drawn, and she says, there's something weird. And then someone is in the house waiting for her, and she too is taken, sort of abducted. Yeah, so you've got the daughter abducted, chapter one, chapter two, similar thing happens to the
mum. And a mother who is abducted as well, but they're wanting a ransom from the mother, etc. So these two threads are running parallel. It's at this point that we sort of have to segue sideways because we can't give out what happens. But, I mean, this sense of menace that you get in when Jody's taken, don't talk unless I ask you a question, he says. When he tilts his head, the absurd little pom-pom on his head bobbles. Don't do anything unless I tell you to. Don't scream. Don't fight. Don't move. If you do, I'll kill you. He adds no emphasis to the word kill. It just rolls out of his mouth. I won't hesitate. I won't feel remorse. For you, it'll be the end of your world. For me, it'll be just another Friday.
I've got to say, it sounds so much better coming out of your mouth, doesn't it? Right? He could do audiobooks. It's incredible.
I'm used to threatening people. But that menace, you sort of up the ante there.
Yeah, and that was part, part of what I love as a writer, and I work in film and TV as well, and it's often you're faced, when you're writing a script, you're faced with limitations, whether it be budget or location or whatever. But I love writing my books. I love sort of giving myself similar limitations because it kind of forces you to be a bit more creative. And really, by starting in such a tense place, it was a real challenge because it could only go up. You know, it all takes place, as the name suggests, it all takes place over a single night. And when the stakes are so high, you just can't think about your day job or relationships or bills. You know, it's just the stakes are too high. So I couldn't, part of that menace was just throwing it all in straight away.
Now, I think we can say that there's a point where this menace is inverted or twisted.
Yeah.
If I don't hear his voice in 3 seconds, you'll never see your daughter again. Wait, she blurts. In her panic, she drops the phone. Don't hang up. 3. Wait. 2. Don't. 1. Something happens. A collage of fragmented moments explodes in her head, flashing like sunlight through the tree branches. If you ever want to see your partner again, and this is Jody now speaking, you will listen to every word I say. You will follow every instruction I give you. Whatever you thought this was, whatever you thought it was going to be, it's not. You have lost control of this situation. She's breathing hard, trembling again. Tell me you understand. So she now uses the same language against the perpetrator in some ways.
Yeah, and I really... one of the things I sit down before writing, I think about the main character's arc, and I really wanted Jody in particular, and both women do it. You know, you've got this young woman trying desperately to get to her mum and a mum trying desperately to get to her daughter, and I wanted them both to sort of find this inner strength and really become, you know, just go through hell and then kind of almost use that darkness and violence against without giving too much away, but I wanted to give her this sort of sense of she kind of becomes a badass, really.
But also then, you know, M tries to take control of her situation, but there's one moment there where M discovers that she has been stalked. She comes across the photographs that have been taken. And so you've upped the antiness of the creepiness and threat here as well. So we're sort of getting into this notion of abuse, which is an issue you actually explore, because at one stage, Em's trying to explain to someone else, you know, well, my Aunt Linda was married to an abuser, in order to try and get them to come out and, you know, identify. And the reply she gets is, oh, it's not an excuse, but it doesn't mean the men are bad people. It's just that sometimes those demons take over.
Yeah. Ooh. Yeah, which is a way of that character just, is it a little bit of denial going on, because she's trapped in this relationship that, that sadly a lot of people get trapped in. And it's just, it's still her... Or not trying to find a way to justify it, but trying to find a way around the truth, yeah. I think.
And trying to, well, there's Em trying to identify with the person or give them an opportunity to see what's going on in order to try and manage her own situation. But that trope is in the background of that abuse and that dominance and that violence. So do you go to that end of becoming as violent yourself to overcome the violence that's perpetrated on you? Now, we are then left questioning the motive. Again, we can't give anything away, but is money the motive for this ransom?
Originally you think it would be money, and you would sort of assume that as the reader as well. You'd think, okay, as a kidnapper, it's going to be money. But it is revealed in ways that I won't go into that there's much more to it than that. And in fact, the money is but a small part of what's going on.
And in fact, it's got to link with Jodie's past.
Exactly.
And she actually knows the answer why they are doing this at one point. And this is where we get onto some broader issues. You touch on inherited trauma. So what children go through impacts on their current day lives. Mm. And how much of that is an influence in terms of the behaviour of the characters?
I think, you know, so much of it is in the book is about buried trauma and what we do with it and how to work through it. You know, Jodie has this traumatic past and she's expressing it through her art, but really she thinks, oh, I'm trapping it there so I don't have to think about it. And of course she has to learn that's not how trauma works. It sort of sits. In humans, trauma sits in the nervous system. You know, really, it sort of sits in the bones. It sits in the body. And so the book goes into stone tape theory, which is about really quickly. You could go down a rabbit hole with this, but essentially, it's this sort of weird fringe theory that buildings absorb trauma as well.
Well, this is where we bring Robin
in. Exactly.
Because her pictures of early Melbourne, big emotionally charged events can leave an imprint almost as if locations have a memory.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people who say I saw a ghost, you know, there's a theory that, no, that's just this echo that of this memory. And that's what, as soon as I came into the building, I know this is not a visual medium, but the building is stunning and I got the history and everything, and I started to think about that, and then I saw Robin's book, and it all felt very right.
It all gels. Well, that's the synergy of things that happen in 3CR. Often we find connections, and you wonder that are inexplicable. But yeah, I mean, again, inherited trauma. We have locations in and around Melbourne that speak like. Or the tree that was taken down,
etc.
Exactly. It speaks. It has a presence. And so we've got to account for these things. But then you've built this trauma into the events and locations and places in this book.
Yeah, exactly. One of the main characters is carrying it with her, and this sort of farmhouse house is also carrying all of this trauma that we get to revisit, And so, yeah, it's often, which was all unintentional, by the way. Smarter authors than me think about this stuff before they write. I just write the first draft, and then I look back and I kind of figure out what it's about.
Yeah, but the reality is people do carry trauma with them.
Absolutely.
Which comes out unexpectedly at times or that they act out. Which is what has taken place here. But basically, how the lives of Em and Jodie intersect, their motivations, the motivations of the characters involved, the perpetrators of the crime, the reasons for their conduct, and the nature of the ransom are not conventional in Christian White's novel, The Long Night. The work is simultaneously gripping and frightening, and it's from a firm press, Jan.
Well, I had more two-dimensional characters than you did. In Robin's book of photographs, so much more to it, called Shutter City by Maiganya Press. Thank you,
now,
Robin.
Anyway. Just talk a little bit longer because I've got to find the next show to bring it up here so we can play a tune to go out on. And here we go. I can't get this to click. Why doesn't it not?
There we go. There it is.
You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.